All right, I'm going to suggest we get started. My name is David Mazenbring, and the title of this session is Enduring Treasure. Why Steve Biko's Words Thrive, something like that.
The band Words Out.
Why the band Words of Steve Biko Thrive. Thank you. Thank you. I want to start with a little penance for my sins last night, yesterday afternoon, in which I just tried to cram so much data in that I left no time for anybody to ask any questions. And I thought it might be an interesting way to begin this evening by letting those of you who were present for the session yesterday, which is how many of you? A few. Have a chance to list any questions that you had coming out of that session. That might be a way to help bring those who weren't present yesterday into the conversation a bit. So, and it would absolve my conscience of
the moment. In the Boer War and all the things following that, where were the African, the Native African people?
They were on both sides. They were pressed into service. They were the servants. So. Yeah, they were, and his question is about the Anglo-Boer War, and in some cases they were in areas of the country that were never really conquered. I mean, they were politically controlled, but they were, if you move around South Africa, there are areas where it's all skyscrapers, and there are areas where there are mud huts with thatched roofs on them. And in some of those concentrated areas, traditional African life continues today. The economy is desperate. They're seen as migrant labor camps to recruit people to the mines. As long as whites have been in Southern Africa, they've been hiring blacks as cheap labor to do their work. And so both sides of the military conflict, and the Anglo-Boer War, pressed them into service. They were all over the place. They were working in the mines. They're all over. Other questions? We may not answer them all tonight, but at least we can list them. Questions arising from last night.
You started last session with, why do you think apartheid came to an end?
Mm-hmm.
We went through all the history, and it looked an awful lot like the Afrikaners had the various moves of the resistance under control. Biko was starting to do something, and then he was killed.
Right, yeah.
And so, yeah. I still wondering whatever brought apartheid to
what,
him.
What was Biko's role in bringing apartheid down? I know, that was a miserable failure on my part. He's very good at spotting my weaknesses. I'll remind you that quote that we'll read at some point, I hope, tonight from Steve. The most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. And fear, as long as apartheid was able to impose fear in the minds of blacks and a sense of inferiority, then the police state tactics worked. But as Biko's black consciousness came into prevalence, people were so convinced of their humanity, and we'll talk a little bit tonight about black theology, the importance that black theology played. In fact, let me find it right now, because it would, we might miss it later, and it would make this point really well. Biko was very critical of the first people to come and to relate to blacks in a human way in South Africa were the missionaries. They were in the vanguard of the colonialization movement to quote-unquote civilize and educate the savages and introduce the Christian message to them. The religion they brought was quite foreign to the black indigenous people, but African religion in its essence was not radically different from Christianity. We also believed in one God. We had our own community of saints through whom we related to God, and we did not find it compatible with our way of life to worship God in isolation from the various aspects of our lives. In other words, he this is not quite the one I wanted, because he goes on here to talk about how traditional African religiosity found ways of worshiping God everywhere all the time. They didn't take an hour out on Sunday morning in a church, and so he's taking a little dig at the churches there. While I do not wish to question the basic truth at the heart of the Christian message, there's a strong case for a re-examination of Christianity. It has proved a very adaptable religion, which does not seek to supplement existing orders, but like any universal truth, to find application within a particular situation. Well, I don't have this quote lined up quite the way I want. But he says that that he is several times in the book when he's addressing black clergy, he admonishes the clergy to get over the trivial moralizing and to interpret Jesus as one who fights for the poor, for the underdog. Fights. He uses that word repeatedly, that we have to see Jesus as fighting for the black people in this context and in this situation. So it was the idea that people at one point he says it's a sin to allow yourself to be oppressed. And black consciousness taught the notion and conscientized clergy with the idea that it's a sin to allow yourself to be treated in an inferior way and for you to internalize that sense of oppression, using Sunita's phrase from the other day. It's a sin to allow that to happen. And so on June the 16th, and then you have in May, Biko's defense of black consciousness at that trial, that famous trial, and the Soweto newspapers are covering it. And 6 weeks later, the students decide to march against being forced to be educated in a language which is not their own, and they get mowed down. How many were killed on June the 16th? I've forgotten. There was a massacre, the Soweto massacre, children. 16-year-old children, peacefully, there were 16-year-olds marching in by the thousands, you know. They weren't throwing sticks or carrying guns or anything like that, and the police mowed them down. And urban black South Africans, educated black South Africans, those who had some schooling, were incensed in a way that could not have happened 10 years earlier, would not have happened. People would have been scared by the bullets and they would have gone home and locked themselves up in their homes. And in this case, the whole country just started burning. The one township after another started burning. And the place never settled down from 1976 until the late 80s. And as it broiled, really, Desmond Tutu talks about how the time in the mid 80s when the police were killing kids, young people in the townships, faster than priests could bury them. And there would be, at funerals, new violence would break out of an incensed sense of injustice, that it's a sin to allow ourselves to be oppressed here. And so that, it just fueled an ongoing frustration, refusal to accept being murdered and buried quietly. So people, there'd be some kind of an incident, the police would shoot people, the funeral would be a really tense affair, and some spark would ignite, and then there'd be more shooting and more funerals, and it went on and on and on. We'll look more tonight at the phenomenon of black consciousness, what Biko meant by it. And it was, in my thesis is that it was that sense, as you listen to his words tonight, it was that doctrine that we have been duped into thinking that we are inferior, and when we set about the business of recovering a sense of dignity for who we are, then we will not allow ourselves to be oppressed. And I believe that's what happened in conjunction with the rest of the world's growing impatience and economic sanctions that had been called for at an earlier stage but ignored, and particularly when the United States came on board. Keep in mind that Europe imposed economic sanctions much earlier than the United States did. And that hurt South Africa badly. And then you added U.S. economic sanctions, and then the government, rather bright government in South Africa, saw the handwriting on the wall and started to have secret talks with Mandela and said, wow, the guy's pretty impressive. Maybe this can work. Maybe we can work with them. And they freed him from prison, and then the cat was out of the bag. It was a constitutional convention, democratic elections in 94, and it all changed. But I think the black consciousness issue was key. And we'll look tonight at what its continuing relevance for us is. Any other questions arising from last night that you didn't get a chance to ask, but you wanted to?
Is your book translated into Spanish yet?
It's a very bad Spanish translation. Yeah, it's a very long story. I'd be happy to tell it to you privately, as I feel really badly about it. We just got taken for a ride by someone who had their own agenda and wanted to publish it in Spanish for her publishing house, and it's a very poor Spanish translation. There's a very good Brazilian Portuguese translation in Brazil. There's a German translation. So let's the book. The current U.S. edition is published by the University of Chicago Press. Are there still copies in the bookstore? Anybody?
Yeah, I got the last copy.
Okay, well, this is the last one. So there'll be one more. You got the last one that's up there. I borrowed this one so that I could wave it around in front of you because I'm working out of an older edition here. And I will take this back to the bookstore in the morning and somebody who wants it can get it. It has 19 chapters. It has accumulated various forewords and prefaces, one by Desmond Tutu, one by Malusian Tokum Pumwana, who knew Steve like a brother and a sister. And Malusi's now an Anglican bishop. There's a couple of introductions and prefaces. At the end of the book is a memoir by Aylward Stubbs, an Anglican priest who knew Steve from the time he was about that tall, and who was closer to Steve at the end of his life than any other white person, and who introduced me to Steve, which I will always be very grateful for. The memoir is a personal story. The way the book got started was Aylred got kicked out of South Africa. He had a ministry among the banned, and one of the ways that an effort was made to circumvent the government's system of silencing these politically active people and restricting them to a police district is. Aylred, as a priest in the Order of the Community of the Resurrection, he would just move among these banned people as their pastor. And the good Dutch Reformed Afrikaner government didn't really want to prevent people from having their pastor visit. So Aylred would move around and he communicated among them and he had their trust. About a month before Steve was picked up and then killed, Stubbs was refused re-entry to South Africa. He had gone home to England to visit his dying mother, and while he was there, the South African embassy comes out and says, you can't go back. He was a British citizen, so he didn't need a visa, but they could tell certain Brits, you're not welcome, you can't come. So he went to Lesotho, which is a little country surrounded by South Africa, and spent time at a mission station there of Anglican nuns. And he had asked the Bishop of Johannesburg to use me to replace him. There's Lesotho, right in the middle of South Africa. Joburg is up here. And Aylward had arranged for me to replace him. I mean, he's interrupted by not being able to go back to the country. So I start working in the role that he had, just to finish out the year. He's in Lesotho, Steve's killed, and somebody delivers a letter to me. He smuggles a letter to me saying, I've been asked to do a biography. Would you go see Steve's mother and widow down in King Williamstown and Donald Woods in East London and then go on to Cape Town and talk to the following list of people and then come and see me in Lesotho and tell me what they think about the idea of me doing a biography. And what they thought was that one of Steve's basic principles was that white people don't speak for black people. Black people speak for themselves. So a biography really needed to be done by Steve's, by black South Africans. And all of the people who would be best able to deal, to work on that, were all in detention. He's killed on the 12th of September, the 16th of October. 19 black consciousness organizations are banned. All their files are confiscated and carted off. And it was an effort just to kind of eradicate any trace of this movement organizationally. And all of the people who had been leaders are in detention, and God knows when they're going to come out. So the advice I had been given led me to argue successfully was what was so persuasive about Biko were his own words. So let's see if we can collect his own writings and get them smuggled out and published. And then, Edward, you add a memoir that doesn't claim the objectivity of a biography. And that's the book that has stayed in print for 30 years. So the 19 chapters by Steve include some that are miscellaneous, like a little biographical introduction, a piece that was written for a book that's probably one of the best ones and best things that he ever wrote, an interview with him by I'm not sure who, a trip report he wrote after visiting black campuses after he started the Black Students Organization. Some of the best stuff are the five issues of Frank Talk. He used the pseudonym Frank Talk to write a column in the Black Students Organization's newsletter. And the column was called I Write What I Like, so that's where the title of the book comes from. And five of the chapters are Frank Talk. And we're going to start with the first one he wrote. There are five speeches in there, two at clergy meetings, two that were given to SASO was the Black Students Organization he founded at their leadership training seminars. And then there was one two-day conference organized for leaders of various Afrikaner and English-speaking and black university students associations, an effort to bring these together. And he gave a brilliant speech there called White Racism and Black Consciousness that I'll quote from shortly. So that's kind of the book. And there are, I have on prior occasions succumbed to the temptation to tell some of the dramatic stories about how the book came into being. It makes for entertaining conversation or presentation, but it is not the focus of tonight's program. So let's not go there. I now do that as a silent auction in Seattle at various places. So you bid up silent auctions, and I'll take you to lunch and tell you those stories, but not tonight. So a basic tenet of Biko was that there were two problems in South Africa. A problem of a white superiority complex that led to apartheid, and a problem of a black inferiority complex that after 300 years of white domination, blacks had inculcated a sense of inferiority. And let's read a bit, let's hear a bit from him. In this first issue ever of Frank Talk, he's elected president of the Black Students Organization. I said yesterday how he held that office for 1 year. He refused to stand for re-election because he didn't want too much of a cult around his leadership. And then he became, he was elected president of the publications for SASO. And in the first issue of the newsletter, his first column by Frank Talk is entitled Black Souls in White Skins? And he's talking about white liberals. These are the people who say that they have black souls wrapped up in white skins. It never occurred to the liberals, he's talking about the English-speaking white liberals now, the anti-apartheid whites, who he argues not only benefited from the system, but also because they were suffering from their superiority complex, they actually thought that we blacks needed them to design the solution to the problem and lead it. It never occurred to the liberals that the integration they insisted upon, remember, the white liberals are promoting multiracial student organizations, which Beagle participates in, but feels like a second-class citizen in until he leads a walkout and blacks go off and caucus and form their own black organization. The Afrikaners love it. The white English-speaking liberals say, oh, this is racism. You have succumbed to racism. It's immoral. You have to stay in these multiracial groups. And so initially, Biko is defending the decision to avoid integration. It never occurred to the liberals that the integration they insisted upon as an effective way of opposing apartheid was impossible to achieve in South Africa. It had to be artificial because it was being foisted on two parties whose entire upbringing had been to support the lie that one race was superior and others inferior. One has to overhaul the whole system in South Africa before hoping to get black and white walking hand in hand to oppose a common enemy. As it is, both black and white walk into a hastily organized integrated circle, carrying with them the seeds of destruction of that circle, their inferiority and superiority complexes. The myth of integration as propounded under the banner of liberal ideology must be cracked and killed, because it makes people believe that something is being done when in reality the artificially integrated circles are a soporific to the blacks while salving the consciences of the guilt-stricken white. It works from the false premise that because it is difficult to bring people from different races together in this country, achievement of this is in itself a step toward the total liberation of the blacks. Nothing could be more misleading. Since they are aware that the problem in this country is white racism, why do they not address themselves to the white world? Why do they insist on talking to blacks? So his principle was, you put white liberals who say they're against the Afrikaans apartheid system together with blacks who are suffering from an inferiority complex, and whites dominate. And they end up feeling solved, that their consciences feel really good because they're walking around in some other places. He talks about how they feel, here it is. Being white, the liberal possesses the natural passport to the exclusive pool of white privileges from which he does not hesitate to extract whatever suits him. Yet since he identifies with the blacks, he moves around in his white circles, white-only beaches, restaurants, cinemas, with a lighter load, feeling that he's not like the rest. Yet at the back of the mind is the constant reminder that he is quite comfortable as things stand and therefore should not bother about change. He argued that white liberals weren't motivated in the same way that blacks were to get change, and that they only really did enough to make them feel better about themselves, and then they went home and enjoyed their white privilege. You start to see why I think this may have some application to the situation between the rich global north and the south, which is desperate for a glass of clean water. All right, let's listen to a little bit more of him. Now, it doesn't mean that he thought that integration was not a valuable goal. In fact, at one point he argues that in a colorless society, the black consciousness approach, he writes, would be irrelevant in a colorless and non-exploitative egalitarian society. But, he said, we don't have that yet. So, you know, how do we get there? And blacks needed to stop putting themselves in multiracial groups where they let whites lead the struggle for change. What to do instead? Well, he said that was a false form of integration. The concept of integration, whose virtues are often extolled in white liberal circles, is full of unquestioned assumptions that embrace white values. It's a concept long defined by whites and never examined by blacks. It's based on the assumption that all is well with the system apart from some degree of mismanagement by irrational conservatives at the top. This is white man's integration, an integration based on exploitative values. It's an integration in which black will compete with black, using each other as rungs on a stepladder leading them to white values. It's an integration in which the black man will have to prove himself in terms of these values before meriting acceptance and ultimate assimilation, and in which the poor will grow poorer and the rich richer in a country where the poor have always been black. He writes at another point, blacks are beginning to realize the need to rally around the cause of their suffering rather than continue to invest hope in the false promises of the white liberals. Blacks are beginning to realize the need to rally around the cause of their suffering, their black skin, and to ignore the false promises that come from the white world. Here's his here's one definition from him of black consciousness. He says, it's an attitude of mind and a way of life, the most positive call to emanate from the black world for a long time. Its essence is the realization by black people of the need to rally together with their brothers and sisters around the cause of their oppression, the blackness of their skin, and to operate as a group to rid themselves of the shackles that bind them to perpetual servitude. It's based on a self-examination which has ultimately led them to believe that by seeking to run away from themselves and emulate whites, they are insulting the intelligence of whoever created them black. The philosophy of black consciousness, therefore, expresses group pride and the determination of the black to rise and attain the envisaged self. Freedom is the ability to define oneself with one's possibilities, held back not by the power of other people over one, but only by one's relationship to God and to natural surroundings. On their own, therefore, blacks wish to explore their surroundings and test their possibilities. In other words, to make their freedom real by whatever means they deem fit. At the heart of this kind of thinking is the realization by blacks that the most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. If one is free at heart, no man-made chains can bind one to servitude. But if one's mind is so manipulated and controlled by the oppressor as to make the oppressed believe that they are a liability to the whites, then there will be nothing the oppressed can do to scare their powerful masters. Hence, thinking along lines of black consciousness makes the black person see themselves as being complete in themselves. It makes them less dependent and more free to express their humanity. At the end of it all, they cannot tolerate attempts by anyone to dwarf the significance of their humanity. And that's why I argue that it was this mass consciousness raising movement among people because it so offended the white liberals who thought that it was succumbing to apartheid, black caucusing, that it won time for them to go to work. And it was multifaceted. At one point in the chapter that I like best here, chapter 14, he talks about the importance of recovering a sense of religion. It is the duty, therefore, of all black priests and ministers of religion to save Christianity by adopting black theology's approach and thereby once more uniting black people with God. It wants to describe black theology seeks to relate God and Christ once more to black people and their daily problems. It wants to describe Christ as a fighting God, not a passive God, who allows a lie to rest unchallenged. The lie being that apartheid could in any way be just or be acceptable to God. So they went out and said and conscientized black clergy. in order to recover a sense of a religion that was relevant. And then he said, we have to look at the educational system. There's something wrong with taking people away from their parents, putting them in white-led schools where whites are the sole determinant of what is good and what is barbaric. And then, of course, people come back home to their families, and whereas in African tradition, respect for the elders is extremely important, how do you expect a black child to respect their parents when their parents believe things that their teachers have told them are barbaric? So we have to work on the educational system. We have to work on a sense of history. He argued, articulates in several places in the book, the notion that black heroes are absent, completely absent, from white version of history, and reminds his audiences that history for Africans did not begin with the arrival of whites in 1652. He talks about culture, the need to get a clear sense of what is our culture, what's good about our culture. We can innovate our culture, but we shouldn't let it deteriorate. This notion that African culture ceased to further evolve after whites arrived is a function of our inferiority complex, and we have to reestablish, and they went to work on that, a sense of history that empowers us. There's a wonderful statement about history here. Culture, and then finally economic power. And you know, the said, so we're earning money, but we're putting it all into white shops and white banks. Now, the apartheid system tried to instill that, make that the only way it could happen. But black community programs started setting up these black projects and encouraging people to buy black, etc. So that was so. There's this analysis that white superiority complex is best addressed by the white liberals if they really want to be helpful, and a black inferiority complex will require some caucusing. What does this remind you of? This notion of caucusing. Can't believe we don't have any feminists in the room of either gender. I don't know the answer to your question, but I remember very well the time of the women's movement, when women started caucusing and started publishing books for, by, and about women, and liberal men kind of felt excluded from their circles, remember? I remember feeling that way. But it was critical, it was crucial for women to talk to themselves about, to recover some common sense. And as long as they were in circles dominated by men, their voice couldn't be found, or was more difficult to find.
And then black working class women began caucusing from white women of privilege in women's groups.
That's right, that's right. Good parallel. Any other questions at this point before I move to the tough part?
There's undoubtedly a lot more to hear, but I haven't heard anything in his trying to structure equality about black superiority. He just has a very excited aim for what he says is the practical reason why the blacks have to do it themselves. He's not
asserting black superiority. Right. He's saying that we have contributions to make that we cannot make when we have inculcated a sense of inferiority, and when we bring that sense of inferiority into circles of people who have a superiority complex. He said, it's just not going to work. We're not going to have, we're not going to be able to make our contributions. But more importantly, he was saying, we're not going to get free. This, we keep in mind, after that history lesson from last night, those of you who heard it, we're talking about after 100 years of blacks saying, well, the white domination system is absolutely, obviously wrong. Let's go and appeal to their good conscience. And when that didn't work, let's organize mass campaigns of non-cooperation. And when they got mowed down, they turned to armed struggle, and then that only lasted a year or two, and the leadership gets caught and imprisoned and goes so far underground people inside the country can't find them. There is the occasional bomb that goes off during the, particularly during the 80s, late 70s. And Biko starts off trying to work with the white liberals who promise him an end to apartheid if they will only follow along with that white liberal-led system for change. And he came to the conclusion after working with them for a while that, hey, you know, they go back home to their comfortable homes, feeling better about themselves, and I go back to the same bloody thing I had, and when is this ever going to change? And maybe blacks, who are the most heavily impacted by apartheid, are the ones who should count on themselves to fix it. And so they caucus, partly to overcome the sense of inferiority, and then once they get there, they won't stand for subjugation. It's a sin to allow yourself to be oppressed, he says. Now, for the purposes, another question? Okay, for the purposes of what I really would like to see us chew on together tonight, listen to him here. He's talking about the white liberals. And, well, maybe I should read this other one first, 72. There's no doubt that the black-white power struggle in South Africa is but a microcosm of the global confrontation between the third world and the rich white nations of the world, which is manifesting itself in an ever more real manner as the years go by. He wrote that in 72. White racism and black consciousness is the 1971. 1971 says there's no doubt that what's happening between blacks and whites in South Africa is similar to what is beginning, to the consciousness that's beginning to emerge in the so-called third world. I prefer the term global south, which is where, of course, most Christians come from, and we'll come back to that in a moment. Whenever a group of people has tasted the lovely fruits of wealth, security, and prestige, it begins to find it more comfortable to believe in the obvious lie and to accept it as normal that it alone is entitled to privilege. In order to believe this seriously, it needs to convince itself of all the arguments that support the lie. It's not surprising, therefore, that in South Africa, after generations of exploitation, white people on the whole have come to believe in the inferiority of black people, so much so that while the race problem started as an offshoot of the economic greed exhibited by white people, the desire to maintain a cheap source of black labor, you know that South Africa, famous for its gold, has a very low ore-bearing content to its gold. So it needed some kind of an advantage to compete with gold mining in other parts of the world. And that advantage became cheap labor. So if it could have cheaper labor to mine the gold, then it could compete as a producer of gold. And that's just one of many ways in which economic greed was, he says, what started it. But eventually, they started to believe it. So that while the race problem started as an offshoot of the economic greed exhibited by white people, it has now become a serious problem on its own. White people now despise black people, not because they need to reinforce their attitude and so justify their position of privilege, but simply because they actually believe that black is inferior and bad. About 5 years ago, I wrote this article in Holden Village News, and I'm going to quote from it. Steve Biko, a martyr of the struggle to end apartheid in South Africa, offers a prophetic warning for how we discern our sense of call. This is the second paragraph. The first paragraph starts off saying, the way we, you and I, approach social problems is part of the reason they persist. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind what we've been talking about. We've been listening to Biko talk about how the way they were approaching the problem of ending apartheid was part of the reason it persists. The way we approach social problems is part of the reason they persist. Biko offers a prophetic warning for how we, you and I, discern our sense of call. As the father of a potent black consciousness movement, he was severely critical of liberal whites for seeing themselves as blacks' best friends. He argued that the whites' subconscious motives were the opposite of their stated intentions. The anti-apartheid actions of whites helped them feel better about themselves, but did not bring an end to black suffering. If he was right, then the implications are damning for all Americans on the left as well as the right, who believe that we can solve global problems with good intentions. All the right-living policies and justice-oriented teachings at Holden, for example, may only help a few of us in this world's richest nation feel better about ourselves, while the despoiling of God's creation continues unabated. Surely God calls us to employ our privileged resources more effectively. How? Now you can argue with me about that, but if you agree, how? Anybody was present Monday for the critique of charity? Yeah. Where I talked about how charity does more to make us feel better about ourselves, but we somehow run out of energy or resources before we actually solve the problem, but don't we feel good about our charitable activity? So I have a sense of what might be the answer, but I think you might be more receptive to it if we chew on it together first. One, two.
Well, I've heard the charity class elsewhere. Take, for example, a teacher who wants to go to help and teach, and if there's something out of sync, according to Biko, with a white person being a teacher, Biko, I suspect, would say, why doesn't the teacher mentor and enable a black teacher? And rather than impose his or her own talents into a situation that is going to make them
I think Steve would be nervous about the notion that a white is going to mentor the black. He would say black teachers need to go to, blacks need to figure out what they want to teach and what their values are and then teach them.
So you have to look at in the mirror each time you propose something on his test.
Yeah, and it's that mirror that I want to take us to right now. Yeah. I mean, if he's right, and I think he is, we are the white liberals of the world. I mean, we're not all white here, but, the United States, we're pretty much all white here, and we're all liberals here at Holden, most of us. The American church, let's just take the American church. Don't our churches think of ourselves as the advocates for good improvement of the world? And don't we all have opinions on how that can best be undertaken?
Not just the church, the government too.
The government too? It's the whole of our society. Business, government, the church. But I want to hold the feet of Christians, those of you in the room who are Christians, to the fire here. Because I think the problem we have is that we think our circle of American Christians is big enough to figure out solutions to the world's problems. And the truth is, we feel better when we think that way, but we go home and enjoy the wealth that has been appropriated from the world and leaves, let's just take the one problem of water, leaves 2 million people a year dying from something preventable that we don't basically think about. How are we gonna solve that? Go ahead.
Well, I agree with Bill Cole. I've worked with aid programs overseas, and there's no question that the development, in my mind, there's no question that the development process, whether it's economic, religious, cultural, racial equality, gender equality, whatever the upgrade process is, interested in is 85% at least intrinsic, not extrinsic. So the role that we can play is, if any role at all, is in this little narrow 15% zone. And I think that the biggest problem we have with that is culturally we can't stand to see other people stewing their own juice. In other words, struggling with their part of the development process, which means experimenting, failing, a lot of setbacks, a lot of misery, but it's all part of the process. This country went through that at one time. We had a great civil war. If that isn't stewing in our own juice, I don't know what is. We don't have the tolerance to let the others do that. We want to intervene and dictate to them how they can avoid doing that.
But is it just our compassion for them that causes that, or do we have a little superiority complex at work in ourselves that says, well, we can probably think of the answer better than you?
We think that once we have learned it, that we can transfer it.
That's one of our problems, yep. We translate, we think that the insights we've gained, I'm not sure that the development process for Africa is the same as it was for the United States. I don't buy that notion, because I think that the world, the resources of the world are structured differently today than they were when we basically raped the world. I mean, today, there was a time when you had a democratic government elected in Guatemala that sounded like it wasn't going to be friendly to U.S. corporations and was okay for the CIA to go in and assassinate our men, right? That's how we got to the stage where we're as rich as we are. And I'm not sure that Africa's going to get there in the same way.
So should we help? Should we not help?
Yeah.
You tell us what we should
do. How do we do it?
Yeah, you tell us.
Well, it doesn't strike me that the question is about helping. The question is about looking at yourself and changing your circumstance so you're not putting yourself in a situation where you want to or need to or somehow implicitly or explicitly rape the world, where you continue a level of privilege that isn't sustainable or is sustainable on the backs of underprivileged people. So you have to change your privilege status.
I love the self-aware, I'm going to put words in your mouth, you can correct me if I get it wrong. I love the be more aware, know thyself, Socrates said, be more aware of our privilege and the way in which it biases us. Now I'm putting words in your mouth there, but I think that our way of life, I think that economic privilege is a huge and hugely unrecognized bias. We do not believe that our economic comfort is, to the degree that it is, a huge bias on our willingness to really risk change. On Monday, I quoted Garrett Keyser, to help people toward their self-determination is sooner or later to give them power over your self-determination. And we sense that. I mean, how many of us were ready to fight for a democratic world? We're so committed to the values of democracy. As long as it only applies within circles that we're safe, we think the outcome is more or less consistent, where everybody's got basically the same economic interests. You know, given that poor people in the United States don't vote, it's okay to promote democracy, right? And what about on a global scale? Now, we're out of time, but I'm going to give you two. Oh, no, we got 10 minutes.
I think you're right on with what you said, but also there's a sense that I see going out there lacks sustainability. It's not like we're helping them to catch fish. We're trying to provide the fish for them. And I think that's often, if you look at USAID or others, or even some of our mission things, we're trying to go out there and put the Band-Aids on rather than pull back and say, okay, what is it these people are asking us to do? We're providing, you know, solutions to things that that are just short-term.
I think you're right. And I think we also do it by hanging on to power. How many of us don't believe that if it's our money, we really have a responsibility for how it's used? Talk about U.S. church money. So for that reason, we're not really prepared to make the resource available to a board of directors which is led by people from the countries of need. We think they'll mess it up. Tomorrow, tomorrow I'm going to work with microfinance. One of the hottest strategies for addressing global poverty. And I'm going to begin with a critique of the most popular microfinance provider in the United States. Who knows what that is? Kiva. Who said it? Yep, Kiva. We'll begin with a critique of Kiva, which is an American dominated, owned, operated program of microfinance. And I will end up by talking about the oldest, largest, and best, which happens to be an ecumenical organization that Americans are only 6% of the capital for. We only provide 6% of the capital for the largest, best, and oldest microcredit organization in the world. We have the best game in town. And we don't even know about it. And why is Kiva so seductive and the other one not even on our radar screen? The one that's not on our radar screen, the board of directors is dominated by representatives. It's a cooperative of churches globally. But whether you're the Church of Sweden with 15 million euros of investment or some African church with 250 euros, you get one vote. And as a result, the board of directors is dominated by people from the borrowing countries, not the investing countries, and it's working. So power, who holds the power in the decision making? And is it because we have the resource to invest, is it our right and our responsibility to hang on to that power? Or is there something about the Christian message that suggests making yourself vulnerable to the interests of the whole body? And the interests of most Christians are, in purely economic terms, fundamentally different than mine. So if I sit around in a circle like this and try and come up with solutions for the world, I will sleep better tonight, feeling better about myself. But I probably am not motivated to get the job done because it promises to reduce my comfort, even as it raises minimum standards of someone else's. So since if I'm aware of that and I carry that bias, then I need to figure out how to put my resources and skills at the direction, not the cooperation, not when we're at the stage of saying, well, we should get Sunita to come in and sit around the circle of our global mission office, right? But do you and people who look like you dominate that office, or are you at the table? There. And what do you think of everything I've been saying? Because it would be a little, I don't want to put you on the spot, but
no, I think you're
Right.
I'm really interested in obvious thing about where poverty lies. If you look at even our bishops, who's like 65 bishops, who's elected to those posts, or where the power lies and all of that. And so if you speak of it that way, and I've been told that as a person of color that I have to work twice as hard to be in the job that I am, to make sure that I'm not pointed out. I have to be extra, better, to be in the director position, but I also said that I have to do MDiv and then my PhD in order to be heard or to have any expertise after that, otherwise there would be degrassity, a little expressions of power. But even when I constantly you're told that where you come from and what gives you value or is underdeveloped or you're barbaric. And even the whole point about this water and having, learning how to fish and giving someone a fish, all that is skewed because my people have been fishing for a really long time. It's not that we don't know how to fish, but you don't have access to water. How do you feel about making space in the pool, first of all, for people to, so, you know, there's so many in that image of charity versus justice, or there's so many biases when you're coming at it in that manner, you don't know where to start.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think by building the circles in which we hear each other and remember the limits of what we bring to the table, why does it have to be a national church? When Christianity shouldn't be so bound up by national boundaries. It really, I don't understand that. And why aren't we prepared to work with the global church? Well, for one thing, I mean, someone came up to me and said, you know, if you're, I mean, he didn't say this, but that's how I interpreted it. If you're concerned about the inclusion of sexual minorities, you really want to put yourself at the hands of the African church. You know, look at what the Anglican Communion is going through. I think we want to put ourselves in contact with one another. I'm sorry.
So here would be a radical idea. Let's imagine that all of us here are representatives from the home offices of Lutheran Hunger Appeal, Oxfam, Church World Service, World Vision, and they're waiting to hear back from us. And we return from Holden and we tell all these bureaucracies, in the next year, pull all overseas people home. Stop working anywhere except in North America and dedicate all of your work to converting the American Congress and American CEOs who claim religious sensibilities. Because you could argue that that's where the problem begins, and we, all entertaining white skin privilege, can speak one-on-one with the American Congress and leaders of corporate America, and if some kinds of economic theory are correct, it isn't we have really clever ideas for Africa that will solve their problems, it's that we need to bring to an end the oppression of a certain kind of global capitalism that makes it impossible for them to thrive. So talk to our own people, ourselves actually, who are possibly the root of the problem, instead of salving our conscience and giving aid to Africa and Asia.
I used to think that there would be that the goal was to find the one right strategy and then promote it. I'm now inclined to think there's lots of different strokes for different folks. But I'll tell you the one that I want to work on is building global community in which I find a proportionate place, not derivative of my privilege. That's what I think I'm called to do. And converting Congress, which I worked hard on, particularly during the anti-apartheid years, and which probably needs a little bit more work, needs to be the problem in Israel. But just to build communities of Christians in which I learn how to be a little voice instead of a dominant one would be progress. That's one.
I have something from the balcony up here. On personal I statements, something that I'm working on, I appreciate the saying global communities. But one thing in my travels, mostly in Latin America, is that I've been working on what I see as a reversal instead of giving and being in the power of giving is receiving. And I know in communities where we could say they have very little resources, for me it's been very educational and a very difficult position.
need and what it's like to be there and receiving, instead of I'm here with something that I can give you knowledge or whatever. So it's been a very learning experience for me the last year to be in the position of receiving, and I see it as very reversed as persons from the United States and with my privilege who have not put themselves in that position.
I love that. And it reminds me that, you know, although that's a beatific vision you paint for us, Don, what we might actually be able to do is to stop this consciousness that we have to do mission trips and save everybody. I mean, I have tried to take groups outside of this country through churches and say we are not going to do anything. And it's nearly impossible. People won't go. Oh, we have to build a school, or we have to do something to help them. And to make the case that the best help we can give the Global South is to simply find out how they live is so hard for us to absorb. I think to just go on trips that actually learn how people live would be to offer the South one of the best gifts we could think of.
I was speaking to a woman who's married to someone from a very different culture, and she said that the biggest challenge in their relationship, even though they've been married for some time, was actually understanding each other, because he culturally comes from it's hard for us to understand that other human beings can actually be rooted in almost a different consciousness. When he comes into a room, he senses it, he senses energy, and he knows what to do. He already sees what's going on. And in our culture, we're cerebral. We figure it out. Mm-hmm. We get the clues. So they really come from two completely different realms of understanding, and they make that marriage work, and they work really hard at it. And I would say for most of us that haven't lived in another culture deeply enough, we probably don't, and I myself really don't understand that there can actually be a different consciousness around how we move through the world. And to me, many of these things we're talking about need to be solved or need to be hammered out on an interpersonal level to the point where we really get it. Because really, we're no different from all the colonials. We take our mindset and we imprint it upon the world and we solve it for them.
Right. That's a great place to end. It is an hour. And if you want to stick around, I will be here. But my commitment is to be here.